This is an excerpt of a recording from the 2006 National Conference on Organized Resistance. The panel presentation was called Throwing Down Against Empire: Military Veterans Speak Out on Practical Strategies to End War. The U.S. anti-war movement is successfully using counter-recruitment as a strategy to weaken the military and galvanize anti-war opposition in working-class communities and campuses around the country. Meanwhile, resistance in the military by GIs is also on the rise, with soldiers refusing orders and coming out as conscientious objectors. Veterans are at the center of our anti-war movement, and this panel brings together veterans of the Persian Gulf and Iraq wars, who share their experiences of resistance and organizing, and propose some new strategic approaches for building an anti-war movement that can end this war and challenge imperialism. Amy Allison earned an honorable discharge as a conscientious objector during the Persian Gulf War, after serving 4 years as a combat medic in the Army Reserves. Today, she supports soldiers applying for CO discharges and writes and speaks about the experience and role of GI resistance in ending the Iraq War. Aiden Delgado is a U.S. Army Reserve soldier recently returned from combat duty in Iraq, including 6 months at the Abu Ghraib prison. He received an honorable discharge and was awarded 4 service medals. He was ultimately granted conscientious objector status and is now attending a Florida Honors College, completing a degree in religion. He has worked with Iraq Veterans Against the War and Veterans for Common Sense. In this excerpt, Aiden and Amy reply to a question about anti-war strategy. What are some of the ways that anti-war activists who are outside the military can support disaffected soldiers and bring them into political activism?
By way of talking about strategy and anti-war activism, I first want to lay out my personal framework for how veterans or soldiers become involved in the peace movement or in political movements. And it's just my thing, or, you know, we kind of came up with it. It's not like a fact, or it's not in a book. But this is the way I framed it in my mind, and I think it may be helpful to analyze where the peace movement is putting disproportionate focus and where there's not enough focus. So I want to talk about kind of 5 stages of being a soldier. The first stage is being a young person, fresh out of high school or in college or elsewhere, and you enlist. And this is the area where counter-recruitment is active to prevent people from initially enlisting. We have approximately 1 million soldiers armed forces of all branches active in reserve, approximately 1 million. Then there's a period after a young soldier has enlisted, when they go to basic training and they experience a period of sharp initial disaffection. And I would safely say about 95% of soldiers would be willing to quit within the first week of basic training. Most don't, but there is a period of disillusionment. And this can actually happen several times. The first time is in training. Probably it happens again when they get deployed overseas or when they go through some traumatic experience. But there's an initial period where the soldier realizes, wait a second, this is not what the recruiter promised me. The third period is military service. And this can be for varying length. For many soldiers, this doesn't entail war. This entails garrison duty or reserve duty. But in today's world, it basically means you're going overseas. Virtually all reservists will end up serving overseas at some point in their life, in Iraq or Afghanistan. For me, this was 1 year in Iraq. Right now, this is just a ballpark estimate. I'm sure it's not on, but it's in the neighborhood. We have about 250,000 soldiers deployed overseas. About 150,000 in Iraq, probably 50,000 in Korea, maybe another 50,000 in Japan and some more in Germany. So this is probably a low estimate, but we have approximately a quarter of our forces deployed. After military service, either when your enlistment expires, you're honorably discharged, or you return for some other reason, there's this period of homecoming. In my case, homecoming from war, but from a lot of soldiers that may be returning from basic training. It may be the termination of their reserve duty. But there's a period when I would say soldiers' enthusiasm or morale for the military is at a nadir. They finished whatever it was they were doing, and there's kind of a void in their life, especially for people who are returning from war, when nobody cares about your war stories, nobody wants to listen to you anymore, they're tired of you, you feel disconnected, you feel like you'd only talk to other veterans, and there's this huge gap in your life, and there's something wrong. And this is where, kind of in this period, where things like suicides or withdrawal from yourself or psychiatric problems develop. And you notice I've kind of scribbled this line here. This is kind of a barrier. It's a permeable barrier. But most soldiers never move from this point to political activation, to becoming activists. Most don't. Some do, on either the left or the right. But this is kind of the thing that we have to cross in order to get veterans to become activated. The final stage in my arc of the activist is the political activation or veteran status, where you become one of those veterans that they trot out to, like, be a token and give talks. This is what we're trying to get to, political activation for veterans. Amy and I were just talking about this earlier, not counting Vietnam veterans and previous conflicts, of which there are many. There's probably less than 50 veterans in America today who are from the current conflict who are very active speaking. Probably a lot less than 50 who are active, going around, giving talks, talking about their experiences. And at the final level of people who are really active on the national scene, traveling here and there and giving talks, it's probably only 10 to 20 veterans from the current war who are really serious about talking and serious about activation. And so kind of the arc I want you to think about is how we go from 1 million active and reserve forces, and they go through a funnel of experiences, deployment, then political activation, and we come down to 10 to 20 people who are seriously interested in talking about their war experiences. Because there's a lot of disaffection. I mean, probably 95% of soldiers go through serious disaffection. But because nobody is there to catch them at this point, the military is able to fold them back into its ranks. And so what I want to talk about is where the peace movement is today and where they're putting their energy. And I would say that most of the energy of the peace movement goes in these two endpoints. An enormous amount of energy, and this is not a criticism, this is a good thing, is going into counter-recruitment. I've done it myself. I've spoken to probably 6,000 high school students in several different venues about, I don't like to call it counter-recruitment, but I like to call it honest recruitment. Because I don't think we can really make a good case to say you shouldn't join the military at all. But I think when you give people the facts about the military and you show them the alternatives, no thinking person will make the choice to enter the military. So that's how I like to frame it. We're putting an enormous amount here to stop people from entering the military. And we've been relatively successful with that. We've made a lot of progress. I mean, I think it was San Francisco voted all the recruiters out of schools, and there's been several other victories. The recruitment stand down with the unethical recruitment in Colorado. I don't know if you heard about that. So this has been a strong point. This has been a real victory. The other area where we're putting a lot of effort is in this. For people who are already politically activated, sending invitations to Amy and I, sending invitations to the, you know, celebrity veterans out there who are doing 95% of the talks and 95% of the activism. So this part is well covered. I think the peace movement is pretty well connected to Bring Them Home Now, Iraq Veterans Against the War, people who have already made this transition. What I want to talk about is these three stages where I think we need to focus a lot more effort into catching people. Because I think the real defining moment for getting veterans involved is here. And this barrier. To get the enormous number of returning veterans who are not satisfied with their experience or are disillusioned to make the leap from just being sitting at home feeling disaffected about the war to coming here and becoming an active veteran. And this is a whole gradation of experience. So I want Amy to kind of jump in on the sections that she's really been active in, which is the initial disaffection training at some of the military service.
We thought that as a group, we could come up with some ideas about concrete actions that we can take. To tell you the truth, one of the things, other than just like Aiden, working with young people, giving them options for their future, is this initial disaffection. There's a website called peace-out.com, peaceout.com, and it gives some basic information about military conscientious objection. On that website, there are 20 veterans who have been conscientious objectors who volunteer themselves and have their contact information for people to get advice, specific advice. And on a weekly, sometimes daily basis, I get emails from all over the world from soldiers asking for support. And in that case, I email back. Sometimes I give them my cell number, and we start this relationship I give them. So that typically happens in here. So that's something that you know, that as a veteran and as a conscientious objector that I can do. But there are some concrete ideas about peace movement in general reaching out to soldiers. I just want to ask the group, do you know where to find soldiers?
BWI.
Yeah. Wait.
I mean, how to get in touch with soldiers?
How do you get in touch? Any ideas?
Walter Reed
Hospital.
Yeah. Okay, Walter Reed is an Army hospital where they treat returning casualties. Another idea, if you didn't know, churches get mailing lists of soldiers to send them care packages overseas. And overseas, like in Iraq, we had like a mound of care packages like this high that people would just like toss onto the mound because there were all these churches, like every church in St. Petersburg, all the way down to Naples, Florida, had our unit's address and was sending us care packages. And they had not only the address of the company, but the name and rank of every soldier in the company so they could send them things. And what I'm saying is, rather than, you know, I'm not saying to pretend to be a church, but I'm saying that the peace movement can have access to those very same resources, and which leads into my idea for military service, which is during the Vietnam era, so they say, I wasn't there, there were GI newspapers and underground newspapers and such for soldiers who were deployed and on base. I don't think that's really a reality now, and I don't think it's really a possibility overseas. You're not going to be set at clandestine printing press. But I think the way we can affect people who are on duty, who are at the war, who are on active military service, is through email and care packages. And I mean political email and care packages. For example, if the Baptist Church of St. Petersburg can send candy and shoe polish to soldiers overseas in little boxes and have one package go to every member of my company, there's no reason that the peace movement can't access the same file, send a care package to every member of that unit with candy and whatever you want, and also a little thing that says, you know, disaffected with the military, here are
here's
some options.
Rights.
Here's kind of subjection. Here's a number to call.
That's right.
Here's CCCO. Here's 1-800 GI Rights.
Exactly.
And here's War Resisters League. On a little sheet of paper.
Exactly. The thing to understand is that lots of soldiers, like Aiden and myself, most soldiers don't even know they have any legal right to even pursue conscientious objection. It's not something they share with us. And so we use the internet as the, you know, searching on the internet. That's how you found the sample CO packet. That's how, you know, actually in my day, it was like even harder to find out information. But if the church can send a little Bible, we can send a card that says, here are your rights, and here are, there's a whole bunch of people. There's a million people in the United States that want to help you, soldier, because we love you and care about you, and you have rights. And just getting that information to people who are on, you know, who are activated, who are serving in Germany and in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, can start the cycle. Because I get emails. Everybody has email, right? All soldiers have email. And although it technically, just like any, you know, the government could, you know, screen it or whatever, it's too big. They can't control it. So a lot of the soldiers through email can get in touch with support people in the States. One of the things that was mentioned is the GI Rights Hotline. The GI Rights Hotline is the War Resisters League and a whole bunch of other organizations have an 800 number and a website that specifically focuses on military people and their rights, you know, for discharges. And everyone in this room could get training as a counselor on the hotline. And I recommend, if you're serious about stopping the war and you want to talk to soldiers directly, that is the most concrete way that you can do that. You get in touch with War Resisters League or CCCO, objector.org, GIRights.org.
Is it 1-800-GI-RIGHTS? Is that the number?
It's 1-800-9-FY.
Yeah, we don't know, but it's GI Rights. It's GIRights.org. And you can sign up for a training. Once you get a training, basically the training is, all right, here, you know, here's the primer on the basic rights. Then you sit on the phone and you get calls from soldiers or their families. And that is the most concrete way for you to feel like you're helping support our troops, which I'm so sick of that phrase. You're supporting the troops by helping them to resist the war. Because our experience bears out that most soldiers have a lot of questions about what the role is
that
they're playing.
And for people who have a question about the dynamic of how that would work, let me tell you my experience, which I think is pretty typical.
all the disaffected members of a unit will cluster together. They all know each other. Everybody knows the people within a unit who are not with the team or not down with the war. And if you send out care packages, you only have to get one message to one person who's disaffected. And that will spread to everybody else in the unit who's having any doubts. It'll be like, oh, hey, man, I heard about this. Let me show you this. You know, I heard this about this GI Rights hotline. You know, I'm going to look it up next time I'm on the web or next time I have phone time. So all you have to do is get to one person. It's not like you have to change the company's mind. You get to that one person within in the company, and that will spread, kind of like a mind virus, if you want to call it that. But also by email. Every soldier, I don't know if you know this, there's for the Army, it's AKO. I think it's different for everybody else. But you have an official military email, and you get all your mail through that so they can screen you and whatever. But every member of the Armed Forces has an AKO email address and account. And you can look it up and find their name, their rank, where they're deployed, what unit they're with, and what their address is. Like if you want to send General Karpinski an email right now, you can go to AKO, look up her name, and send her an email address wherever she is. So that's possible for every soldier. And all you have to do is get one email to one member who's having doubts, and it'll spread to every member of that unit.
That phone number that you said that we can call, is that for, you can't call that if you're active in service,
The thing about phone calls overseas, you could call it, and it'll be fine from like Germany or Japan. The way phone calls work overseas, in my experience, you get like 10 minutes on a DSL phone, which is like through the military network. So if you're like, you have to call a base in the U.S. and then tell them the number and they connect you to the number. So it's conceivable they could, but with 10 minutes and like bad phone service, you're not going to be making phone calls. So the key thing overseas is emails and written things that list websites you can go to. Because you do get internet time, more or less. Okay, that's kind of my picture of the military service part while people are deployed. And we'll come back to this later and we'll do more brainstorming. I want to move to this, the return home discharge, and this chasm between being a discharged soldier and being an activist. This is something that's near and dear to my heart, and we were talking about it earlier. And I'm going to throw something out here that might be a little challenging for people. I'm a very liberal person. I'm probably on board with, you know, 95% of the things that people discuss here. I'm ultra-liberal, you know, freedom and liberty and truth and justice. But when I come to these to an event like this, I feel out of place. I feel somewhat uncomfortable. Just because the way, you know, people dress and the way they act and stuff, it's a little jarring for me. And I grew up in under Sharia, like under Muslim law in Egypt. So I'm not used to seeing that kind of thing, even though I'm a very liberal person. Most soldiers are far more conservative than I. And if I walk into this room and I feel uncomfortable and I feel kind of like, oh, maybe I don't fit in here, then what is a soldier from Texas, Kansas, or Iowa going to feel when they walk in here with no sideburns, you know, wearing a white shirt, wearing jeans, you know, wearing dress shoes? What are they going to feel like? And how are they going to feel connected to this community? And I'm not saying that everybody here should put on a white shirt and a tie, nor that they should become like more like us. I'm saying there's a huge chasm of subculture and identity between returning soldiers and the people in this room and the people upstairs. And we need to work on a bridge between people who are, you know, like Kevin Benderman, who recently went to prison, who's a Georgian, he never went to college. He spent 10 years in the Army. You know, very rural Southern.
I can't believe you said that.
And how is he ever going to come into this room and feel supported and feel connected? And there's got to be a bridge between that experience, which is the bulk of people in the military, and the people in this room. And I think one of the bridges to get from there, well, first of all, it has to be gradual. If you push people too hard and too fast, you'll lose them. For example, if we go up to soldiers who are just coming back from the Army and maybe they're curious, and they come to see what the anti-war movement is all about, and they hear down into capitalism, into hierarchy, you know, into whatever, that's maybe a little bit too much. That may be like way outside their horizon of possibility and experience. So we need to kind of be more gradual. And I think one of the stages of that is Iraq Veterans Against the War. Because Iraq Veterans Against the War is made up of all veterans. We're all, you know, liberals, we're progressives, we're on board. But it's people they can feel comfortable with. It's people who've had the same experience, who are not too far out there. And then once a disaffected soldier comes into Iraq Veterans Against the War and begins to get a little taste of that, then from Iraq Veterans in the War, they can transition to coming to events like this. And Iraq Veterans Against the War sends people out as speakers or as representatives to events like this. So I'm interested in people's ideas about how to cross that gulf. And I'm suggesting that Iraq Veterans Against the War and other organizations like that are a good intermediary between pure activism, people who've never been in the military, and pure soldiers or pure veterans. They're kind of a halfway step.
Right. That's the so the two takeaways we hope kind of emerge from this conversation is, one, that the message, as we support soldier resistors, we have to be thoughtful about the way that we message things. If you send a box of candy and a, you know, we love you and you have rights, that's very different than saying, you know, here's the ultimate political objective of me sending you candy and telling you this. We don't need to go that, you know, so let's be very thoughtful about the message when we reach out. And we need to make sure there are veterans within the groups and organizing, because people like Aiden, people like me, are the bridges. When he says Iraq Veterans Against the War, I can count the Diana Morrison, who just came back from Iraq last year, Catherine Jashinsky, I want to talk about her case, who's refusing deployment to Iraq, Afghanistan, and others. It is veterans who can help, who have made, the few here, and we hope this number grows, that have somehow made the transition to political activists. We are the best bridge to get people coming back to help them gradually become the political activists and outspoken people that we absolutely need in order to educate the general American public about what's happening in the war, and to also encourage other soldiers. Because my own case in courage applying for a CO discharge came from a speech I heard when I was on campus. I heard this guy, Eric Larson, who was in the Marines. He took his dog tag, threw it down. He said, I'm not going to, you know. And I said, if he can do it, I can do it. And we need that right now. We need a strong cadre of veterans speaking out. So those are some things. And I know that we've got to go back and talk specifically about Catherine's case and take some questions. But just in general, hopefully this rubric was helpful.
That was an excerpt from the 2006 National Conference on Organized Resistance, featuring Amy Allison and Aiden Delgado. The complete recording and others from NCORE will soon be available on the website of the Washington, D.C. Independent Media Center.